This is Aurelia.
And this is Damien.
Welcome to the Breakfast of Ideas podcast, a series presented in collaboration with the Center for Information Technology, Society and Law and the Digital Society Initiative at the University of Zurich.
In this week's episode, it's our pleasure to welcome Lee Bygrave, who is a professor of law at the University of Oslo. Professor Bygrave studied law in Australia, came to Oslo for a PhD, and ended up becoming the director of the Norwegian Research Center for Computers and Law. In the past 3 decades, Professor Bygrave has been advising various bodies on numerous aspects of ICT policy, such as the European Commission, the Nordic Council of Ministers, or the UK House of Lords Committee on the Constitution. Also, he's a co-editor of a soon-to-be-published Oxford commentary on the EU General Data Protection Regulation. So as you can imagine, we were very excited that Professor Bygrave came to visit us on the ITSL and give a talk on cybersecurity, which you're about to hear right now.
So, security by design. This is a topic that I've been looking at over the last 6 or 7 months, and what I'm going to talk about today is very much work in progress. And as such, I will be probably raising more questions than answering these questions. So I'll start off with a teaser slide. And this is the dole, the lemon, and a storm. And these are 3 images, all of which appear to be rather disparate. There's no innate connection between a dole, a lemon, and a storm. At least at one level, but as I'm going to try to demonstrate over the next few minutes, there is indeed a connection between each of these elements. And what I've used them because I see them as symbols for a fundamental misalignment or a set of fundamental misalignments in the cybersecurity space. And these misalignments end up creating the storm. So, what are these fundamental misalignments? First of all, Internet of Things and artificial intelligence, amongst other things, bring with them a myriad of new security vulnerabilities. And this is where the image of the dole symbolizes this particular vulnerability, because the dole was not just any ordinary dole, it was a dole with Bluetooth capabilities. This is an image of Kayla, C-A-Y-L-A. You might have heard of Kayla. Kayla rose to fame a couple of years ago, a product of the US company Genesis Toys, and a dole that was marketed here in Europe but ended up being taken off many European markets because of its Bluetooth capabilities. And through these Bluetooth capabilities, the dole was actually able to allow people to eavesdrop in on what was going on in the space in which a dole was placed. That space being, given these are dolls, often children's rooms. And the German federal authorities ended up, in fact, bringing a prosecution action against Genesis Toys for introducing into the market a device for espionage, for covert espionage. And but you can still find Kayla marketed in the USA and in my home jurisdiction, Australia. But nonetheless, what I think is fascinating about Kayla is that you have this apparently innocent and well-meaning object, but nonetheless introducing a range of security vulnerabilities that many of its purchasers, the consumers, would not be aware of, at least when they bought the product. The next aspect is that at the same time as we have these new security vulnerabilities, security doesn't pay. And it doesn't pay in several senses. First of all, it doesn't pay because what happens is that a lot of the major security scandals that have occurred over recent years don't end up being sufficiently punished. The people in the companies that have been responsible for security go largely scot-free. The companies themselves are rarely fined large punitive sums that get them to rethink their security culture. And also, security doesn't pay in the sense that companies that are marketing products that are part and parcel of Internet of Things, they don't build sufficient security into their products in the first place. Because security for them is a costly drag on investment, and it's often something that consumers don't really appreciate. So security doesn't really come with the bells and whistles in the marketing of products. What consumers want is convenience, and in the IoT area, in the cyber area generally, it's all about seamless communication. And security can often get in the way of that sort of seamless communication and the convenience that comes with it. So there are some excellent studies done on the economics of security generally, and also in respect of cybersecurity, that demonstrate that in effect the market for security is a lemons market. And that's where the second symbol comes in, the lemon. So the lemon there is a indirect pointer back to the famous work of George Akerlof, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2001, but is most famous perhaps for a paper he published in 1970 on so-called lemon markets. He wasn't concerned with cyber stuff, naturally, back in 1970. He was looking at the used car market. But his basic point was that there are fundamental information asymmetries in many markets where the seller, the vendor of a product, has greater knowledge about the capacity of that product than the purchaser. The purchaser at the same time is interested in paying the least amount of money for the product and won't necessarily appreciate certain intangible features of a product. And what, through a complicated economic analysis, Akerlof says, what you end up getting is this deterioration in the market for high quality, highly enhanced products. In his case, it was used cars. In our case, it would be, let's say, IoT products like Kayla the doll with IoT capabilities. And in that sort of marketplace, the consumers aren't interested in a doll, first and foremost, because of its security capacity. They want a doll that is going to give their child joy. And it'll be the communicative capacities of that child that will be in the front seat here in any consumer choice as to what they buy. So we have in the security field then a lemons market to some extent. But we can't be too black and white here, because while at the same time the market for cybersecurity might be a lemons market to some extent, there are nonetheless a lot of firms that are looking now to make more than lemons out of their putative enhanced security of their devices. So the trend goes both ways. So I guess basically that what I'm looking at here is that the relationship between the doll, the lemon, and the storm is doll plus lemon equals perfect storm. So there is then a connection between the doll, the lemon, and the severe weather pattern. And it's the Equifax hack that occurred evidently in early 2017. That's what we've been told, at least, that I think also is a nice exemplification of everything I've been talking about so far. I call this not security by design, but security by disaster. Everyone familiar with the Equifax hack? Some of you will be, some of you will have forgotten about it, as most people have. Some of you will not have heard about it. This was Equifax, as I guess many of you know, is one of the largest global companies in credit reporting, US-based, In early 2017, a lot of its customer data was hacked, but the company evidently only found out about this security breach in July of 2017, but took another 3 months before they went public about this hack. And the result of the hack was that over 140 million people's sensitive information was compromised. This was predominantly customers in North America, but also some in the UK, some in Australia. Not sure about Switzerland, whether Equifax has any market percentage here. But the point is that if we look back at this scandal, what happened to Equifax? Very little, particularly in North America. The Trump administration basically said, oh, look, yeah, that was tough, but we're not going to penalize the company. We're not going to go after the company with punitive sanctions. There is litigation progressing through some of the states, but very little has happened. Equifax lost, its share price went down shortly after the scandal went public. But what do we see now? Its share price is back up, and in fact, it surpassed what it was over a year ago. It's looking to make a very healthy profit this year. So in other words, it's more or less business as usual. And this, I would suggest, is not a good thing if we want an enhanced consciousness about cybersecurity and the risks of IoT. So, to the rescue, perhaps, comes Security by Design. And over the last 18 months, Security by Design has sailed up as this mantra, at least rhetorically, in various policy documents. And now it's being trotted out also in hard law. The European Commission, back in 2017, in its Cybersecurity Strategy for Europe, flagged the use of security by design methods in low-cost digital interconnected mass consumer devices, which make up the Internet of Things. That was in September 2017. Arguably, as I'll come back to, we already see elements of security by design in the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, particularly Article 25, Paragraph 2. But also in the recently agreed EU Cybersecurity Act, which was agreed upon in December of last year, you can see that security by design ideals are implicit, particularly in the certification scheme that the Act will be setting up, as I'll come back to a little bit later. Just quickly, what is Article 25, Paragraph 2 of the GDPR about? It's basically saying that the controller, that is an entity that determines the purposes and means of processing personal data, shall implement appropriate technical and organizational measures for ensuring that, by default, personal data are not made accessible without the individual's intervention to an indefinite number of natural persons. So this is, in effect, really about keeping data locked up. And I would say that is at the heart of security, not just data protection. But it's part and parcel of a broader principle of data protection by design that is set out in very long-winded fashion in paragraph 1 of Article 25, which you either already know about or you can read very, very briefly for yourselves. Also in the UK, security by design has sailed up as a nascent policy goal. So the UK Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport released in March of last year, a year ago, a report called Security by Design, in which it encourages companies to, as you can read, design IoT products and services with security in mind from product development through to the entire product life cycle. And interestingly, the UK report flags particularly the economic problems that I flagged at the start of this seminar as a cause for their work on security by design and encouraging companies to think this way. Now, so far, what's happening in the UK has only ended up as soft law. So the report issues a draft code of practice, but significantly, the UK government says, if you, the private sector, don't get your house in order, we're going to introduce legislation ensuring that you get your house in order. And then if we move across the pond, as it were, to the US of A, we have security by design now a explicit statutory requirement in California. So this is the new security of connected devices legislation that's been put into the Californian Civil Code. And as you all know, California is no minnow in global terms. It's what, the sixth or seventh largest economy in the world as a jurisdiction. So what California decides has global ramifications, and particularly when we think about the fact that it's the home of much of IoT development. So there's the one of the provisions that is relevant here. So a manufacturer of connected device shall equip the device with a reasonable security feature that are all of the following, blah, 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 designed to protect the device from unauthorized access, destruction, use, modification, or disclosure. I'll come back to that a little bit later. There's also, in the next provision, an authentication requirement, which is, fairly comprehensible. Note that this is the sole security standard that is fairly concrete. You know, the previous set of provisions are quite generic and have led to a lot of consternation on the part of industry in California. The usual question, what does this mean in practice for us? And of course, a lot of worrying about how this will affect innovation. And then in Australia, this isn't probably very relevant for you, and Australia is not exactly California for Europe. There you've had a predominantly industry-led discourse, again with some soft law emerging. But interestingly, again, security by design explicitly being flagged as an approach to countering the problems with Internet of Things. I won't go through more on the Australian situation now. While I've been so far flagging this as something new, that is only a half truth, because security by design, as certainly Aurelia is aware, is part and parcel of a much longer regulatory policy discourse on by design generally. And I would say that this sort of really came to the fore back in the mid-1990s in the field of intellectual property rights, where you had work on what was then called electronic copyright management and electronic copyright management systems, ECMS. The idea being that you should use aspects of the then emergent internet to ensure that intellectual property rights were respected in the online context. So rather than just seeing the internet as a threat to IPR, one could in fact harness aspects of the internet to strengthen IPR. And that nomenclature, ECMS, later morphed into DRMS, Digital Rights Management Systems. And as some of you are aware, you had also hard law reform, not least in the WIPO Copyright Convention from 1996, which introduced explicit protections in Articles 11 and 12, I think, on protection of so-called copyright technical measures for protecting copyright, and also protecting so-called rights management information, digital watermarking in effect. And those provisions in the WIPO copyright treaty were later replicated in Articles 6 and 7 of the InfoSoc Directive from 2001, number 29. And so IPR, where I think you had, first of all, this idea of using technology to cater for and strengthen particular interests, and also amending the law to try to bolster that strengthening. And then in the field of privacy, we've had work that initially focused on pets, privacy-enhancing technologies. Also from the mid-1990s, 1995, there was a famous report issued by the Dutch Data Protection Authority and the Ontario Privacy Commissioner that was called Privacy-Enhancing Technologies. That nomenclature later morphed into privacy by design, particularly under the steering of Anne Kevoukian, who was for many years the Privacy Commissioner of Ontario and was probably the person who did the most to get privacy by design up on the agenda of data protection authorities and others through the 2000s. And then in Europe, privacy by design has ended up as data protection by design, as exemplified in Article 25 of the GDPR. But I said early 1990s, but you could perhaps go even back to the work of Norbert Wiener on cybernetics and say that, you know, his work on cybernetic systems was also, in a way, articulating this idea of designing in certain values in information systems architecture so that those systems respect the values. And this is often called value-sensitive design, and there I've got some references to some of the leading work, Wiener's work from the 1950s, and then later Batya Friedman's work in the 1990s, and most recently, I think the work of Sara Spiekermann in Vienna is also very, very relevant here. But we see also this design vocabulary creeping into other contexts, which you wouldn't expect it to creep into. So recently, a Danish colleague of mine, Hanne Marie Motzfeldt, at the University of Aarhus, has started to talk about administrative law by design. And she's published a paper on this. What she's basically arguing is that in administrative law, Verwaltungsrecht, you should start to think about a new basic principle, which is that the technology respects the other core principles of administrative law. And she calls this the principle of administrative law by design. But as I'm suggesting, it's still a rather underdeveloped argument. So stay tuned, hopefully, for more from her later. So what is the legal regulatory vision? I guess basically what we're trying to achieve, or at least the design folks are trying to achieve, is that you start applying legal norms not after the fact, not ex post facto, but ex ante. So you try to head off breaches of law, you try to head off incursions into the values that are being designed into the technology and the information systems that the technology is part of. At the same time, the legal regulatory vision has a concrete manifestation in hard law. I mentioned the developments in copyright law. It was copyright law that first manifested this sort of design philosophy in actual provisions, and now the GDPR has done a similar thing in Article 25 for the field of data protection. And more generally, we have this body of discourse that particularly Mireille Hildebrandt and Bert-Jaap Koops in the Netherlands have fostered. They talk about legal protection by design. They also talk about ambient law. Are you familiar with their work? Some of you are? Okay. Well, I mean, what they mean by ambient law is making the law part and parcel of the environment in which it is operationalized. So it's not the law as a discrete entity and an environment. You bring the law out into the environment and you then create ambient law. And the idea is that the environment then reflects and reinforces what the law is trying to achieve. Now, this is all very, you know, abstract, but this is the legal regulatory vision, pie in the sky. Now, let's try and get a bit more concrete. So, what is security? What is security? And here I've asked, is this more than safeguarding CIA? This is not safeguarding the CIA. For those of you who are not familiar with security discourse, this is about safeguarding the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of information, networks, and information systems. Does it, for example, include this notion of resilience that in my home jurisdiction has crept up as a very important element in security discourse? In other words, the idea that systems ought to be made generally robust. So it's at a higher level of abstraction than safeguarding CIA. I think it does. I think security is generally being used in a very broad sense. And I think also that it's more than about safeguarding merely information and data. If we bring resilience in, it's also about safeguarding information systems architecture. But then we have another question, which would be, okay, is it more than simply technical issues? Is it more than simply the technical mechanics of a system? And I would say, yes, it ought to be. But I'm not convinced that all people in this security by design discourse agree here. But if you look at the Article 25 of the GDPR, for example, I would argue that it's not just about technical issues, it's also about business and organizational cultures. So it's about resource allocation. It's about deciding who gets what money to do what. Okay, so those sort of human resource aspects and the organizational cultural aspects, I think, are very much part of any good security discourse. Ensuring that management is not just severed from what goes on before the chief security officer, but is part and parcel of that deliberative process going on with the chief security officer. But if you look at the Californian IoT Security Act, I would say that it seems to pitch security by design as focused on technical issues. And that's why I said I'm not sure that all people who are flagging security by design as an answer here are with me when it comes to the more non-technical aspects. The California legislature is addressing the engineering community, Silicon Valley, in a sense, much more directly than Article 25 of the GDPR does. But, I'll come back to this later, Article 25 of the GDPR is also addressing the engineering community. But this is another point. But it's doing so in a way that doesn't speak the language of the engineering community. So I think it fails in its communicative efforts there. But if I've got time, I'll come back to that later. So the next question then is, what is design? And when I first started thinking about design, I just more or less took that notion for granted. Over the last 5-6 months, I've been looking into this notion of design not as envisioned by lawyers, but as envisioned by people in information systems. And the general conclusion in that field is that design is very polysemantic. And the work by some Australian colleagues of mine conducted almost a decade ago shows this quite well. This is the work of Mackay, Marshall and Heath, where they conclude after going through a large range of literature on design in the field of information systems, conclude that there is no single, all-encompassing definition of either information systems or design in information systems. And this left me flabbergasted. I thought, oh boy, what does that do for regulatory discourse on design? And has that discourse factored that in? But I nonetheless think that it's fairly obvious that what we're talking about with design is intentional activity. And I think that's what we in the legal community almost automatically or intuitively associate with this notion of design. In other words, we're talking about a prescriptive set of actions that are the product of forethought and hopefully foresight, which is contrasted with the Equifax scandal, which was security by disaster, or another contrast would be security by accident. Oh, we just happened to have a good level of security, but we didn't know that. So we're talking about intentional security and not incidental security, in my opinion. Back on this notion of security, I'm not suggesting that security by design is the same as data protection by design or privacy by design. I think we have to, while there are significant overlaps, they are nonetheless conceptually and to some extent regulatorily distinct. They feed into each other, but they're not always fully commensurate, particularly privacy and security, just to make that clear. Now, I have a question at the bottom of this slide. How hard does the hardwiring have to be? And this question I've raised from my work on privacy by design and data protection by design, and it was catalyzed by debate not quite last century, but the very beginning of the new millennium around the status of P3P. Who knows what P3P is? Platform for Privacy Preferences, a W3C standard. Who knows what the W3C is? Okay, World Wide Web Consortium, right? Now, the World Wide Web Consortium, set up by Sir Tim Berners-Lee, developed standards for the World Wide Web, which is part of the internet, but not the internet. And one of these standards has been Platform for Privacy Preferences, which basically, very, very simple terms, enables a browser and the website which the browser is visiting to exchange in milliseconds respective preferences as to the privacy settings that each are operating with. And there's a type of negotiation. And if there's no harmony between the respective sets of privacy preferences, then the person using the browser is alerted. Now this happens to some extent still, you know, with where you get an alert, you are visiting a website that doesn't have an appropriate certificate, whatever, da da da. So P3P was an early version of this. The question was whether P3P was a PET, was it a privacy-enhancing technology? And Larry Lessig, professor of constitutional law at Harvard, but who later became more famous for his work in cyber law, he said, P3P is a PET, a privacy-enhancing technology. And he saw P3P as one of two essential elements for safeguarding privacy in the digital context. The other element was to ensure that data subjects have property rights over the data about them. So It was technology in the form of P3P and property rights that, in Larry Lessig's opinion, would save privacy in the online world. Mark Rotenberg from the Electronic Privacy Information Center took issue with this argument, and particularly over the status of P3P. And he said, Larry, in an article writing What Larry Doesn't Get, he said, Larry, P3P is not a pet. At the most, it's simply a negotiation tool in a market. It doesn't ensure a privacy-friendly outcome. And this debate, you might think, is really just of academic interest, but it's not. It's all about to what extent a product can market itself or be marketed as a solution to a perceived problem. And Larry thought it was right to use P3P as a pet. Mark Rotenberg said, this is disingenuous. It's not a pet. It's not a pit. That is a privacy invasive technology, but it's certainly not a pet. And the question was, one of the differences between the two was because for Mark Rotenberg to be a pet, there had to be a certain hardness in the hardwiring of privacy outcomes. Whereas for Larry, there didn't have to be that hardness. So in the cybersecurity context, there's a product that assures with, say, let's say 90% security, if you have a product that is more likely than not to enhance security, is that to be seen as an element of a security by design strategy? Or is it enough that the particular product only stands a negligible chance of enhancing security? You will understand? Yeah. And we don't know this. If you go, however, Californian Act, it says, designed to protect the device from unauthorized access, destruction, use, modification, or disclosure. It's not saying it actually does have to achieve that. It has to be designed to do so. So it's in my opinion, ambiguous here on this particular issue. On the other hand, it does mention reasonable, doesn't it? Reasonable. And that would perhaps imply that the manufacturer at least has to be able to document that it has acted in accordance with, say, relevant industry conceptions as to what is good practice in the area, but perhaps nothing more. Let's see. Now, methodological challenges. So, down in the corner we have Anne Kavoukian, who I mentioned earlier. Thank you. And Anne Kavoukian, as I said before, was an ambassador for privacy by design. She said that her vision of privacy by design seeks to deliver the maximum degree of privacy by ensuring that personal data are automatically protected. And I asked in a previous paper I published, what exactly is the maximum degree of privacy? Huh? I mean, it's fine rhetorically, but when you start thinking about it, what does this mean concretely, it's really hard to provide an answer. And the question then would be, well, what is the maximum degree of security? And this is where we're into this sort of reasonableness and all that fluffiness with legal standards. Another question is, would the security by design functionalities have to go beyond the legal requirements? And I ask that question because Kavoukian said, my vision of privacy by design is not tethered to legislation. It goes beyond legislation. So in other words, the North American legislative standards on privacy, which are, compared to Europe, on paper, fairly weak, they were not the parameter, the benchmark for assessing what is reasonable privacy. and what is sort of maximum privacy. Whereas if you look at the GDPR, Article 25, that uses the GDPR's own standards as the benchmark, because security, data protection by design is all about ensuring that a data processing operation respects the regulation and thereby secures the fundamental rights of the data subjects. But it's the GDPR that is the universe for that particular principle. Some more methodological challenges. We don't have many operational principles on security by design as opposed to rhetorical flourish. Can we borrow things from, can we borrow principles from privacy by design? Well, those are Anne Kevoukian's 7 privacy by design principles, which are great on paper, but again, rather vague and ambiguous as operational principles. And these are, by the way, endorsed by data protection authorities around the world as setting the gold standard for what they regard as privacy by design and thereby data protection by design. So some practical problems. One problem, obviously, is that information systems often end up taking paths of development that were not foreseen when they were first established. And information systems development, and you can, I'm sure, add to this. I think people outside information systems development often think of information systems as these complete, monolithic and static processes with very nicely defined borders and very nicely defined aims, when in fact they're often amorphous. They are sometimes semi-chaotic and very, very fluid, and where the people in charge of them don't fully understand what's going on. And I've talked to people in the public administration in Norway who are responsible for tax income administration, social welfare administration, and one of the big challenges there is that the software that is still running these systems is really, really old, and the current employees in these public agencies are not being trained in that software. This is the old software from the 70s, so it's the oldies in that organisation, this is the human element again, who are the memories, as it were. But we're coming to a point where there's going to be there's patching, but it's going to come to a point where things break down in a very, very chaotic way. And this is an example of sort of information systems development that is also one of decay, in a sense. And I guess you could say the internet generally is a prime example of an amorphous set of networks with very unclear boundaries and unclear lines of legal responsibility, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I guess the basic point is that if information systems often end up being used beyond what designers can predict, then design is not a one-off process. It has many, many iterations, because there will be information systems maintenance, upgrades, et cetera, et cetera, each of which may result in a new set of decisions being made by humans. Okay, so I agree fully that the humans will never, in practice, be outside the loop, even if the vision is to minimize the mistakes that humans make. The human element will always be there. By the way, this notion of the absent artifact comes from an information systems theorist, Per Galler, who talks about that in an information systems design process, before the system is actually established, there's a lot of conjecture involved. The designer will be envisioning something that does not exist, an absent artifact. Another problem is that how the designers of an information system conceptualize the functionalities and aims of that system will not always be in harmony with how the users of the system conceptualize the system. So in the words of Dorish, the users and designers do not in fact share the same model of the task domain. And then this is something that's come up in the information systems literature. The communicative and behavioral, the so-called user-centric aspects of design are frequently not emphasized by the designers themselves. Many of you know the famous joke where one information systems developer says to the other, "You start programming, I'll go find out what they want." Right? So there are these sort of parallel universes where the universe of the user is quite often quite different to the universe of the designer, and where the designer doesn't speak properly to the user. Some other practical problems, poor market traction, and I think we see this particularly in privacy by design, data protection by design. There aren't that many products yet where the security of that particular product is a big winner in the mass consumer market. ICT engineers, how focused are they on security by design? At my home university, this is in Oslo, security has only recently become an elective unit in the computer science degree, the Bachelor of Computer Science, an elective unit. There is now talk of making it a mandatory part of the basic computer science curriculum, but this is pretty recent. There are a lot of people in the engineering community for whom the fundamentals of security are rather foreign. Okay, now, they may respect security because they've been asked to do so, but it's not part of their DNA. It's not part of the basic training they received when they went to university. And I've talked to computer science graduates, at least in Oslo and in Australia, and they agree with me. But they say things are changing. It's changing. Security is becoming more salient in the curriculum. But nonetheless, as cybersecurity becomes more and more the relevant security environment, we are facing a huge shortfall in the number of software engineers with appropriate security training. I saw one estimate, and this is always sort of, you know, take a figure and sort of put, yeah. And one estimate, I think worldwide there'd be a shortage of 1.8 million software engineers with you know, security expertise, whatever that means, by 2020 or 2022. I've got the figures somewhere here, but the point is there's a shortfall. And I was recently part of a Norwegian government committee looking into reform of the Norwegian institutional framework for cybersecurity, and this was one of our basic problems that we flagged for Norway. A small country with not many people, this shortfall is very, very problematic. So we hire people from overseas, but for security work in the defence sector, that's problematic. Obviously. I've also got this question. Is there a potential clash between security by design and the approach that I've been told is endemic in a lot of information systems development? And that is this so-called minimum viable product approach. In other words, it's an approach that says you only do what is essential to achieving the functionalities of what you've been asked to do. Nothing more. And unless security is part of that, it's just going to be ignored. right? It'll be one of those sort of luxury elements. And I guess you can look at the internet and the way it's been built up as a nice example of this. You know, the internet is, now we're talking about TCP/IP, it's based on the end-to-end principle, which basically means you keep the channels, the piping between the nodes of communication, dumb, and whatever intelligence you want to build into the system, you build it into the nodes, but not in the pipes. Okay, keep things simple, because then you have a robust system that can be adapted to all sorts of unforeseen scenarios, right? And that's one reason why we have all of the security problems we do have in the cyber world. And that was, I guess, a good example of the minimum viable product approach, even though they didn't use that terminology back in the 60s and 70s when the internet was being conceived. I'm not going to answer the question, but it's an important question. Now, finally, and we'll conclude in very shortly, some political issues. And this is where I start getting... I mean, the other stuff was interesting, but this is, I think, really, really interesting. So, question. Does security by design design away politics? I mentioned earlier that there is an assumption by some people with, say, data protection by design, that if you implement data protection by design, data protection will take care of itself. There will be no fundamental value conflicts. You know, the politics will be taken care of. And I think that's always very, very dangerous to assume. But it needs to be, the same question needs to be asked here with security by design. I don't think, and I'll come back to why security by design doesn't design away politics quite soon, which will indicate my answer is that security by design may try to design away politics, but it will fail to do so. Next question. Does security by design make value choices too easy for consumers? So because this is one of the motivations for security by design in relation to Internet of Things products. Consumers don't understand all of the communicative capacities of the myriad devices that they're hooking up, their fridges and cars and their dolls, etc., etc. So we need to ensure that all of those devices have inbuilt security. It'll take care of itself. Consumers won't have to think about security from then. We trust the experts. Now, this relates to some extent, I think, to what you might have been saying. And this is whether security by design can get in the way of consumer satisfaction. And I refer to the Sony PlayStation 3 dispute. What was that dispute? This was a dispute between certain users of, and some of whom would have been purchasers of Sony PlayStation 3, that had modified the operating systems of their PlayStation modules so that they would run on Linux, right? Now, Sony didn't like this because it was potentially threatening the fences they are building around their products, right? The digital fences, and to some extent the profit-making fences. Now, what some people have claimed that Sony then deliberately disabled the PlayStations which had these modifications take place, using security as the pretext. Right? We can't update the product now, and you need to update because it'll benefit the security of our product. therefore we're cutting you out. And this raised obviously a lot of consternation amongst those who had modified their PlayStations to run on Linux. And they would claim that Sony here was using, in a sense, security by design as a pretext for achieving other goals that had nothing to do with security. It was about protecting turf. So, political, economic dimensions here. And of course, why is this relevant for consumers? Is because the people who were running Linux said, we do this because it enhances our enjoyment of the Sony products. So for them, consumer satisfaction was dependent on having a more open and flexible operating system. So it just shows how you could see, you know, security by design being used in certain senses to foster another agenda. Note that California's new legislation does not impose any duty upon the manufacturer of a connected device to prevent a user from having full control over a connected device, including the ability to modify the software. So, in other words, the Californian legislature has taken a line that is in conformity with the wishes of consumer choice and, I guess, thereby innovation. Finally, does security by design add to security theatre? And as you all know, especially when you're going through airport controls, there's a lot of security theatre. And there is a possibility of security by design, I think, adding to that. The Sony PlayStation 3 dispute, you could say, is an example of security theatre. You go through the motions, but maybe not that much is really achieved in terms of real added security. And whose vision of standards of security does security by design promote? Obviously, again, we had a difference between Sony and certain Sony customers about their respective standards of security. But this becomes, I think, more important in the state-citizen relationship. The question, I guess, the underlying question that I'll leave with you all is, and finish up, is whether security by design may reinforce securitization of government policy in an authoritarian direction.
After Professor Bygrave delivered his talk, we took the opportunity to ask some follow-up questions.
Thank you so much for doing this. It's really an honor to have you here and to be able to have you on our podcast. That is really cool for us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So in your talk, the question popped up how security by design is linked or connected to privacy by design. Could you elaborate a bit more on this relationship?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess at one level, they are closely linked in the sense that they walk hand in hand, and that's related to their basic aims. So the aim of privacy by design and now more recently data protection by design is to ensure that the information systems architecture with which we operate has within it the basic principles of the General Data Protection Regulation and data privacy law more generally. So that architecture respects those principles. And you can say the same thing with security by design, except that it's focused on security rather than privacy and data protection. And it's in relation to the sort of components, I guess, of what is being designed that you get nonetheless some differences, because security is not the same as privacy. And while a certain level of information security is necessary in order to arrive at a certain level of data protection or data privacy, the two are not fully commensurate. So just because you've got good security doesn't mean you're going to have good privacy. And that's in one sense, security is has a narrower focus. It's got a more technocratic focus than privacy and data protection. But on the other hand, it also has a wider remit, because while privacy and data protection only are concerned about protecting personal data, data that can relate to you and I as natural physical persons, security measures are concerned with all sorts of information, ensuring the confidentiality, integrity and accessibility of data, information systems generally. So it can serve the interests of corporate players just as it can serve the interests of individuals. And I think it's also interesting to reflect over the way in which conceptions of security have developed over the years. When I first started looking at this back in the early 90s, it was then quite common to talk about CIA, but not just CIA, but also what you might call CQA. In other words, security was not just about ensuring confidentiality of information. It was not just about ensuring integrity of information, that is, to ensure that information remains unaltered. And it wasn't just concerned about accessibility of information, that's the A, but also the Q. And you might ask, what is the Q? That was quality of information. So back in those days, security was conceived by many as also concerned about how accurate is information in relation to what it's meant to represent. And in the ensuing years, that focus on quality has largely disappeared from security discussions. So, one talks just now about CIA, and integrity is not the same as quality, because integrity is all about just making sure that what you put into an information system stays unaltered and free of interference from unauthorized sources, whereas quality is something more. And as you both know, quality is very, very important for data protection and privacy, where we are really concerned about whether the data on each of us is accurately representing us and is being used for the purposes for which it is relevant. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that was clarifying quite a lot and also very interesting. I wanted to point to the fact that you mentioned information asymmetries in the markets, and that there's not really a market for security. And I was wondering, during your talk, would it be possible that, like, data breach notifications could maybe work against these asymmetries, so that, like, we could have, like, a system of naming and shaming those players that do not have proper security standards, and that might alter consumer behavior? Do you think that is possible?
Yes, I definitely think it's possible. And I think it's quite clear that a lot of people these days are much more aware of the vulnerabilities of the many devices that they use on an everyday basis than they were, a decade or so ago. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, people are going to alter their behavior in any radical way, particularly when it comes to their purchasing habits. Convenience will tend to be king or queen. In many cases, although I must say personally, I think about when I'm looking at a device, I think about the security features of that device quite a bit. But I'm not your ordinary Joe Blow, and I think for many of these, I don't want to be derogatory, but the ordinary Joe Blows, a lot of this naming and shaming is nonetheless going to go over their heads, or it'll be just a blip on their BuzzFeed, and then that's it.
So, like how we saw it with Equifax.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So.
But overall, I guess the answer to your question is definitely yes. But it won't be necessarily the answer to resolving the information asymmetries.
Okay. So if we then move away from the individual in the security discussion, and maybe try to take a bigger picture. ENISA is planned to be rebranded as EU Cybersecurity Agency and shall become an important player in laying down standards for the 5G procurement. There has been a lot of talk about that recently.
Mm.
Is that part of also like something you could call security by design, maybe like on an institutional level? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I definitely think that with the rebranding and the expansion of the remit of ENISA, that we would get a sort of security by design at an institutional level within the EU system. And that's a very, very positive development. And if you look at the some of the provisions in the EU Cybersecurity Act, you'll see that ENISA is tasked with conducting long-term strategic assessments of cybersecurity threats and with advising how to respond, including, quote, using risk prevention technologies, end of quote. And while security by design isn't named explicitly as part of their remit, I think you can read a security by design intention into that. And then this is Articles 9 and 10, by the way, of the Act. But there's another interesting provision in Article 45 GA. Now, I'm not quite sure if that's going to be the final numbering, but this is the version I saw it, and I must say it's a little while ago. But there the certification scheme that is being set up is there to ensure that ICT processes are, again, quote, developed, manufactured, and supplied, end of quote, according to the security requirements set up by the certification scheme. So that's very much security by design, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that, actually. Yeah,
absolutely.
You talked about schemes and also about the law, in this case, the Cybersecurity Directive. And, of course, you mentioned the GDPR in your talk. And we were wondering about the role of the law in security by design. The law is usually seen as an actor, but couldn't the law also...
You mean like an enabler?
An enabler, what I mean. Yeah, sure. And couldn't it also be that the law is hindering good developments? Like the example we thought of is the cross-border transfer. It's currently governed by the GDPR, and there are certain standards which have to be considered when data flows abroad. But on the other hand, the whole 5G's procurement situation shows that the risk of cross-border flows might be right there in the components. So is it something like that maybe we have to then also adapt these laws? Or is this something that you think is something different?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. And I am not really sure how the rules on data transfer under the GDPR are going to play out in practice. Mm-hmm. As I think we're all aware, under the Data Protection Directive, there was a hell of a lot of data transfer going on under the radar, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Article 25 and 26 of the directive had, to a large extent, symbolic effect. But not to a full extent, as we all know. It did bite on data flows, but it certainly didn't capture all the data flows that are going on. And it may well be the same with the GDPR, that a lot of the apparent tensions between its aims and other processes that are legally enabled are tensions that remain on paper or in principle more than in actual practice. So it's a bit early days. But regardless, I mean, when you're analysing the law as the law, it's a huge, multifaceted instrument, and there are parts of it which are going to be in tension with other parts of it. So at that level of analysis, it's very easy to find tension and conflict and dilemmas. But it's not just within the law as such, but even if you look at, say, the notion of security, that's also potentially conflicted. Mm-hmm. So measures to enable confidentiality or promote confidentiality of information can also come in conflict with measures to promote, let's say, the accessibility of information. So there are numerous parameters here, legal, conceptual, technological, organizational, that are not always in harmony with each other.
You've just heard from Lee Bygrave, a professor at the University of Oslo and the director of the Norwegian Research Center for Computers and Law. On behalf of Damien and myself, thank you for listening to the Breakfast of Ideas podcast, a co-production of the Center for Information Technology, Society and Law, and the Digital Society Initiative at the University of Zurich. Editing, mixing and music by Eric Larieux. The production team would like to thank the graduate campus of the University of Zurich for funding the Breakfast of Ideas seminars and this podcast series.